Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to you all. This is the Business Day Spotlight, your destination for African business made simple. My name is Mudiwa Gavaza, and for today, we are delving into the world of financial technology. It's a world that we are quite familiar with, and we have explored it from many different angles, over the years. But for today, we're going to be having a CIO conversation. That is a conversation, with the person tasked, with the leading the information and technology piece for one of these financial technology institutions. And for today, we are joined by Sandy Reeder, who is the Chief Information Officer over at Mukuru, and we're just going to be having a discussion about what's going on over in the world of fintech, and also trying to understand the role that women have had to play in that particular industry as one that is growing at the pace that it is. Sandy, greetings to you today.
Hi, Mudiwa. Nice to be here. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much for being with us. We've actually spoken to a number of people from Mukuru over the years, and I think most recently we spoke to your CEO Andy Jury, giving us a sense of what was going on in the market, specifically some of the developments in cross-border markets, which is the speciality for a platform like Mukuru. But where I want to start today's conversation is, as CIO, right? We have a pretty firm understanding of what a chief information officer does in a company. But where we wanted to start off is to say, in a fintech sense, in a Mukuru sense, right, how does your role differ from maybe a CIO in a large bank? For example, those are some of the CIOs that we've had, on this platform. But in a fintech sense, does it differ in any way, or is it more or less the same, type of thing, but with resources directed in a different direction?
Yeah. So I think a CI role in a fintech, for me, is really exciting, because in a fintech, tech is the product and the only product. And sometimes in other organizations, the manner in which a financial services product is delivered to its customer in a traditional bank can still be quite over the counter. They tend to have large branch networks, and they tend to sort of offer a much more sort of over the counter, I suppose, delivery mechanism. And so there's a lot of business strategy that sits alongside the technical strategy. What is exciting for me in a fintech is that every single element of what we do is delivered to our customer base or our staff base through mobile technology. And as a result of that, the CIO role is fundamentally the spear of the product strategy within the fintech. And that is what I really enjoy. Because if we don't build it, we can't sell it. And that is something quite exciting. So the ability to be totally and utterly entrenched in the business strategy so that the product strategy can actually affect that is what makes it so exciting. And so from a CIO perspective, my resourcing conversations, to kind of what you asked me, is really around how do we make sure that we are building enough product capability to be a product tech-led organization and drive the business strategy that way. So when we talk tech strategy, we're actually talking product strategy as well as tech strategy alongside that. And sometimes I think in bigger financial institutions, those things are separated. Within a fintech, they're fundamentally combined. And so my role is also the chief product owner. It is also really strategic in terms of how are we defining the strategy that we want to put forward from a product perspective aligned to the business strategy. And so I work so closely with my business colleagues in that space. I think that's probably true for most financial institutions these days because of what tech means in financial institutions and how they work. But certainly in my experience, this is the most tightly coupled I've ever been to the business.
At this point, I'm hoping that because we come from the world of finance, we tend to like, hearing about the numbers as a way to conceptualize, what's going on in a particular, market industry or a company. Are there any numbers, from a Mukuru sense, given the amount of information or transaction flow that's flowing that you're managing, that you could boggle our minds with right now, that you are helping to enable with your tech?
Sure. So we on average process about 1.8 million remittance or money transfer transactions a month through our platform. But we are processing closer to 4 million transactions a month when you start looking at our store value products, the card product in South Africa and our wallet products, which are live in Botswana and Malawi. And so that kind of is north of 4 million transactions a month, which is quite big. In terms of the value moved, through the platform, it is significant. So yeah, quite a large number of transactions that we support through the platform. And Mukuru is a platform business. We're here to be a financial services platform for Africa's emerging consumer, and that covers the use cases around sending money, which is the business that we talk about in terms of money transfers and all remittances. It's then how does someone have access to a store of value through the Mukuru platform? In South Africa, that is a card product that is close to 500,000 active users every single month, so pretty big. And as I mentioned, when you look at that product, that is a significant number of transactions. And then we're looking at the third major use case, which is how do I spend within my ecosystem? So what are some of those typical value-added services, spend use cases or payment use cases that an Africa's emerging consumer needs? And that's payments for airtimes, payments for electricity, DStv payments, those sorts of transactions. And we're sitting at 200,000 active customers who are purchasing in that payments ecosystem, just in South Africa alone on a monthly basis. So hopefully that gives you a sense of some of the numbers.
No, it certainly does. That's a large amount of deal and transaction flow, that you are dealing with. Could I just, as a follow-up, confirm that for Mukuru, given the fact that you guys operate in so many African countries, is South Africa the technology hub, for Mukuru?
So actually, Mukuru's technology hub is quite interesting. We are a fully cloud-hosted platform, and we host in AWS, actually in the EU. So yes, we have most of our engineering staff is based in South Africa, but we actually employ developers sort of in multiple different places. We have a hub in Nigeria, we have a hub in Bosnia, we have two major South African centers in Gauteng. We have a Pretoria and a Johannesburg base, and then in Cape Town, we have quite a large base. But we also then employ all over the world, if we can and we find great talent. So at the moment, one of my exceptional Flutter developers who works on our apps is sitting in Dubai. And so what is great about being a fintech and about being a platform business where it's all cloud hosted is that I can access talent really all over the time zone. We try to kind of employ talent within our time zone so the communication is easier. And but we are starting to really drive that. We have a couple of engineers in the UK. And so we're really quite multinational when it comes to our tech landscape. But yes, South Africa is certainly the hub.
I think right now, in the landscape that we're in, being a developer is probably one of the best jobs that one can have, especially from a remote working point of view. You can work from anywhere and for anyone, as long as your skills, align, and all of those different factors. Now, Sandy, I want to move to, continue with that conversation around being a CIO and touch on a couple of aspects, right? You've given us a sense of what things look like in your specific job, but I'm going to ask you something that I recently asked the group CTIO over at MTN, Mazen Mruwe, and I said to him, It was almost a similar sense, around what they're doing. Because one of the things I'm usually quite fascinated by is what rationale, from a technology investment and leadership point of view, organizations take to appoint a CIO versus a CTO versus a CTIO, or separating out, these various roles. So maybe you could talk to us around what approach Mukuru has taken from there.
Yeah, so my role looks after typical CTO type technology stuff, which would be provision of infrastructure, actually management of staff tooling. So there is an entire IT process that happens with making sure that all of your staff have the right access to equipment and the right tools, from a Microsoft suite through to, whatever you're choosing from a security stack perspective, and emailing and all of that stuff that happens in every single organization, whether you're a fintech or a financial services organization. I look after that. And then I also look after the fact that we are a bespoke product development company building fintech capability for our customers across Africa. And I think the reason why we chose CIO is because that information and strategic product delivery aspect is such a massive part of who we are as a fintech. And so that's the title that we wanted to put in place. And when we start talking to industry players, and when we start talking to partners, knowing that someone is kind of at the helm looking after that absolutely critical element of cybersecurity with product-led strategy in a fintech landscape, that role made more sense for us from a CIO perspective. And so that's why we went with it. But we sort of have looked at a couple of times. We've looked at, do we need to split out a separate CTO? And so what we've done is we've kind of put in the heads of IT and the heads of our various product domains underneath me to deal with those different aspects of this broad spectrum of what is IT within a fintech, and so that we can manage those underneath a single role, and I can play the role of really interacting with my board and with our management committee on covering all of those elements, because if you think of something like cybersecurity, that is fundamentally woven into the fabric of how we host and design the products that we launch to our customers. And so we didn't want to separate it. We wanted it to be all under one pillar.
Okay, that makes sense. When you describe it like that, and especially the fact that you then have the functional areas, having their own heads, underneath that, that CIO, that CIO portfolio.
Yeah.
Sorry,
just to kind of add there, we're quite a lean organization as well. I think we like being that way. So, as we're still growing and we're in this incredible growth trajectory, and as a platform business, I think you can get great economies of scale. And so I think we plan to have a lean organogram for a while, and that may change over time.
One of the things that, then I become curious about when I look at the broader landscape, is that even on this platform, we have engaged with a number of, CIOs and CTOs, and there are a number of, women that are holding positions, such as yourselves. Is that a fair assessment to say that there has been growth in terms of that particular representation, or do you still think that there's a ways to go in terms of bringing in more women into some of these technical roles?
I think there has been great progress. I can certainly see it. I was at an executive event for women in CHRO, CIO, and CFO positions 2 weeks ago. Like, just such a fabulous event, and to see a room full of amazing women who we all got to bring a mentor with us, who kind of is up and coming, a female mentor within the department. And it is a room full of exceptional people. And, I think it's just wonderful to be part of that. And that is certainly a different room full of people that it was 5 to 10 years ago. So I think there has been growth. Anecdotally, because I'm not close to the stats across the entire industry, I still It's still rare to find a woman in my role when I engage across the industry. So I still think there is room to move there. I can talk to our own organization probably better than I can talk to anything else. Within my department, I am sitting with a 44% female representation across the entire IT department. Within my immediate management layer, so the sort of the senior and middle management layer, that's sitting between 20 and 25%. And so there's work to do there on how we grow and nurture and create opportunities for women within our junior management space to move into that senior management space. And I think that's possibly true across the entire sector, finding great young talent, giving women that opportunity, making sure they are effectively trained and nurtured and mentored so that they can step into these roles as they become available is what we really need to be doing, because the statistics are still skewed. It's going to take time, but I think that we've got just some great momentum and some progress recently, which is exciting to be part of.
I'm keen to get your take on, I guess, the split, of that representation. I can speak anecdotally, to say that I went to Rhodes University a few years back, and I did information systems. And when we were doing our courses, you sort of all started out doing they just called it computers in first year. And then from there, you then decide whether you're going to go into the computer science stream, or you're going to go into the information system stream, which is more on the business analysis and that type of side. Just using gender as a metric anecdotally, it was far, out skewed towards women in information systems, and then gents in your computer sciences. So keen to understand, from your own organization, how that split, finds itself, I guess, between people that are more on the business analysis side versus people that are more on the dev side.
So, I'm really interested in this conversation because I went to Rhodes University and studied information systems as well.
Great place, great
great.
place, highly recommended.
And I think what you say is right. Certainly, when I was there, which is very many years ago, that was true. The men went to computer science honors, and the lot many many women chose the information systems honors route, like I did. And if I look at our organization, we look at the business analysis and product ownership space, and then we look at the engineering dev space. And I think that we have more representation from women in our product owners and our business analysts today than we do in our engineers. Finding female actual devs, actual coders, it's really hard. We have great representation in our testers in that space. And so, that is really, really good to see.
Now, given what you've just outlined to us, Sandy, between your engineers and probably people in the product space, it's a bit of I don't want to call it a controversial question, but I'm just going to ask it anyway. Are we trying to balance out representation between the two different fields, or have we just found that this is, I guess, what people would say, this is just what works?
We are actively trying to balance that out. So we're doing it in three different ways. We run bursaries for students who are studying either data engineering or computer science or and sometimes business analysis. And we make sure that there is decent representation in that bursary program because there is great talent in terms of women who are trying to enter those sectors. I think that it is sometimes the challenges are harder, and trying to find those incredible people and nurture them and bring them up is something that we're quite passionate about. So in our bursary program, we're looking for good representation and both from a gender perspective. The second thing that we are doing is we're running internships. So we have an internship program, and at the moment I have a fabulous female dev intern that has joined us. And so making sure that there is someone who's coming through who is fitting that mold. But honestly, it was hard to find those females in our internship program. And so the third thing that we're doing is we're working closely with a company called We Think Code, and we're running something called She Hacks. So it's a hackathon purely for female developers who have been pulled in from We Think Code. We do it in Women's Month. It's happening not this weekend, but next, across Durban, Cape Town, and Johannesburg, where we do a hackathon specifically for women in the coding sector. And we kind of try and find our next group of interns from that group so that we can try and kind of pull this through and try and create some representation. I think in a skills shortage sector like development is within South Africa, you know, I'm trying to get my hands on every single talented developer I can find. And so also pushing a representative gender-based scenario is tough, but it's something we need to keep doing.
Yeah, interestingly enough, and I can name the organization because it's we recently published a session with them on this platform, Standard Bank. I recently attended their, it was a university-targeted hackathon, but one of the things that stuck out to me wasn't the hackathon itself, but it was the fact that in the room, there was a good number of ladies that were in that hackathon. I don't want to say that it was split evenly 50-50, because I do know that I think there were probably more men that were represented there. But what stuck out to me was how many of the women were people that were looking to be coders or were devs. You know, that stuck out to me, and I was like, okay, cool. If this is, it's anecdotal, yes, but if this is anything, because this was Cape Town area and Cape Town universities, and I said, you know, if this is saying anything, hopefully it means that the needle is moving, you know, when it comes to that particular conversation. Maybe one of the things that we can do then, Sandy, because we're talking about talent, we're talking about, you know, being a CIO, we're talking about representation. Your own journey, you know, in the space to end up as a CIO over at Mukuru, what has it taken for you to get to where you are from your days doing information systems at Rhodes?
Yeah. So, I went straight from Rhodes University into a consulting environment, and I actually consulted for 16 years.
Wow.
And in that time, I think I worked at every single bank within the country, quite a few of the insurance companies. And quite early on within that journey, I realized how so often I was the only woman in the room if we were consulting in an IT sector in a bank. And quite often I was one of the youngest in the room as well. And so quite early on in my career, I learned how important it was to make sure that you just are good at what you do. I didn't want to focus on being the only woman in the room. I wanted to focus on being really competent at what I was doing so that my voice could be heard based on my skill. And so when I start to coach and mentor women, I talk about the fact that competence speaks for itself. Like, you just got to be really good at what you do, and you've got to work on how you articulate and make sure that the points that you make come across succinctly and correctly, and you've done your homework and you've done your research. You know, the balance of that is perhaps I had to work harder than the men in the room to get that voice across, but you know, I don't think it set me back. It actually spurred me on to kind of make sure I really stepped up. And due to the context of my world, and I had some great male mentors as well as some incredible female colleagues, I would say, who helped me through that, who helped me through that journey. But I really was given incredible opportunities by the people I worked with at the time, and a lot of them were men, and I really appreciate the space that they gave me to thrive. 7.5 years ago, I joined Mukuru. Was done with consulting, and Mukuru, I didn't join as a CIO. I joined sort of in the business analysis, business architecture sort of area. And quite quickly, I just found that this is an organization where I can add a huge amount of value, where it would be so well received, where my voice is heard. I don't have to fight to have it heard. And it's the first time I really wanted a seat at the table in terms of being in that boardroom. And so when the opportunity came, and my CEO, Andy, said, "Come on, Sands, I think it's time." It's the first time I was really ready to step up. I also, you know, I have two kids. My husband and I have been married for 18 years. We have two boys. Being family orientated is hugely important for me. And I took time earlier on in my career to invest in my very young children when they were younger. They're now teenagers, so it's a little bit different. But it was okay to do that. So, you know, my path, I found organizations that I could work for where I didn't have to apologize for wanting to be a mum and a really successful business person. And so when I look back at my career, I'm grateful for the space to do both, because it was never going to be an either or for me. It always had to be a both. And Mukuru is a space where I can really invest in my family as well as invest in the company. And bring my skills to the table with an exceptional executive team. So, yeah, found a home there.
Now, Sandy, our current generation of young people, whether they're millennials or the upcoming Gen Zs, have been sold a dream that you can have it all, right? You can have the career, you can have the family life and all that. Is work-life balance a unicorn, or is it an actual reality that someone can attain?
I think it's a reality you can attain more than 50% of the time, but not all the time. I work on the balance of things.
I like that qualifier.
I work on the balance of things. If you have work-life balance more often than not, I think you're winning. If you expect it to be there every single day, every single time you wake up, you live in utopia, and that's not going to happen. But I think you know, some of the things that I try to role model is not apologizing or feeling guilty for the fact that you are both a family mum. You know, you're running your family as well as a great contributor at work. I think the first part of the conversation is we don't have to say sorry for that, because so much of what you learn at home, you know, that is unique to your role as a homemaker and a mother, for example, is useful in business. So let's not apologize for that. But at the same time, you've got to get it together. The logistics are hard. Having support is important, because you cannot constantly drop your world at work because something's going on with your family. So it's not an excuse. It's something that you need to manage it. So yes, the dream is possible. Yes, the work-life balance is possible. It is hard. It takes a lot of organization. And that is the point. If you are not organized, it can't be yours. But if you are, and you put strategies in place, and that you've got the right support structures, then I think it's totally possible.
You know, as you were talking, one of the more interesting things that's coming up is the fact that, you know, it's on the balance of things. So obviously, you sort of have to take with that what you may, you know, to say that, you know, if you really want to go far, there will be sacrifices along the way, and unfortunately, these are some of the sacrifices that we talk about. It's not the sacrifices that we want to make. It's the sacrifices that have to be made, you know, to get to where one wants to go. Before we let you go, there's two points that I'm particularly curious about. The first one, once again, on the point of, you know, careers, career growth. We spoke about representation earlier on. I have this thought And I have, edited on a number of platforms before, and I will just proffer it to you, and you can tell me, what your experience has been because you have actual experience in the space. I had this thought initially from a startup point of view, right? Just noticing that the startups that go far or the ones that are raising the most amounts of money, at least in South Africa. And then I started seeing the same trend in other parts of the world, are people that come out of the world of consulting, right? People that come out of consulting, I don't know what's in the water, but consultants don't start mom and pop shops. They start, they want to take over the world, and they know how to take over the world, and they go about and do it. So, as a from an exposure point of view, maybe you could just talk to us about the value of a career in consulting, for whatever ends someone hopes to reach in their career.
Yeah, so I think you make a really good point. I think what consulting forces you to learn to do really quickly is to listen so well for understanding, and then to evidence that understanding by playing back and summarizing what you've heard very quickly and very succinctly. And so it teaches you to think about how to find the nugget in the conversation, how to actually work out what's so important, and then to grab that, summarize that, and talk about that rather than all of the stuff that is around you, all of the noise, because there is so much. You very early on have to learn that skill. How do I listen really well? How do I find the actual nugget here, the real problem? How do I understand it? And then how do I start solutioning? And so perhaps based on your observation, that learning means that there is a good observation of what's going on in the market and where the gaps are, and an understanding of how to grab that thing and really work with it and articulate it clearly and start a solution, because you can find the problem that needs solving long before you've come with all the potential solutions that might be out there that don't actually really solve the problems that people are looking to solve. And so yeah, I think that's what consulting taught me to do so early on, is diagnose the actual problem before you start worrying about what you should do. And that's the nugget of good entrepreneurial startups that make it. They solve a fundamental problem and people are interested in that and they buy.
Yeah, no, most certainly. I think for myself, I'm quite sold on, consulting. It's not a silver bullet, and I don't think it's the be all and end all, but I do think that the frameworks that are taught in that world are very good because, even when you look at just corporates, you do see that people that come out of consulting do well, even in especially in a corporate environment, as well. So, it is a very interesting, observation to make from that point of view. So as we land today's conversation, then Sandy, financial inclusion is a huge thing that people are trying to grapple with. In business school, we are taught about BHAGs, which are big, hairy, ambitious goals. And financial inclusion seems to be the big thing that on the African continent everyone is trying to solve for. Kuru obviously has done quite a bit, for the continent, especially on the remittances, on the remittances side of things. In your view, as a technologist, as someone who's playing in the space, where what's what do you see as being, some of the places where you think a little bit more attention needs to be invested, for us to really move the needle on financial inclusion?
Yeah. So financial inclusion is a journey and not a switch. And so what we've seen often happening within the African continent is there's a lot of players that will provide a wallet, a digital store of value, and put it down and turn it on. Well, we've got financial inclusion, but we don't. And the reason we don't is that using digital store of value effectively is the goal, not signing up for a wallet and then rinsing it the day after your money arrives. And so I think we're measuring the wrong stuff if we're just counting how many customers have signed up for a wallet. What we want to be measuring is, how is that digital store of value transactionally used within communities? And then you start to understand that this is a journey. And it starts with bridging the cash and digital divide. If people trust cash, which is why they keep on taking the cash out of their wallets, how do you build trust in a digital store of value? If you can't transact in your ecosystem in any tender type other than cash, you have to stay with cash. So how are we addressing the merchant ecosystem when we talk about financial inclusion? And that is around merchant-driven wallets and how we get merchants to trust what's going on there. And then it's incremental. So how do you create such trust in the fact that one day when you do want cash, it's always available and there's never a question about that? That's the only time someone's going to actually start trusting that this digital store of value is worth something, and it happens. So having your cash logistics totally sorted out and bridging that cash and digital divide is a prerequisite for building trust and actually creating the start of that financial inclusion journey. So for us, it's about education. We're really excited about the fact that remittances can be seen as a salary for all of those recipients who are receiving them, sometimes like clockwork on a monthly basis. If you can use that inflow into a digital store of value and close the loop in terms of how that recipient can then transact locally with their ecosystem for their payments use case needs, we're onto something special there. And so that's sort of how we are looking to do that, by launching wallet products to recipients who understand and trust the Mukuru brand, who might want to start that first furtive step to trust a digital provider to store their funds and to start transacting digitally. Because the goal here is that your digital money works for you, because you can get access to savings, you can get access to interest, so your money starts working for you, and you can get access to products like insurance, which safeguard you for a rainy day. And that's what financial inclusion really means. So we're looking to provide those products to our ecosystem in both the sender side of things, but also on the recipient side, so that we can close that loop and actually create some financial inclusion traction in those countries.
And with that, we come to the end of what has been a really great discussion and conversation with Sandy, just around what's going on in the financial technology space. As Mukuru, they are a business that actually specializes, in cross-border payments and remittances. And, I think the last numbers that I had, at least, is that they have a customer base of more than 13 million. Across 50 countries in Africa, Asia, and Europe. And Sandy gave us an idea of the level of transactions that are happening in that particular organization, more than a million when you're looking at cross border. But when you then go up and start looking at some of their other products, such as wallets in South Africa and the like, then that number grows quite exponentially until you're about at 4 million. I think that's the number that she said that they're dealing with on a monthly basis. Also, at the same time, looking at people that are transacting and giving the additional value added services, airtime, electricity, DSTV, all of these things that people are doing. Because towards the end of the conversation, Sandy was talking about the fact that if you're going to help to reduce the use of cash, then we must be able to close the loop on the type of things that people can do with their digital stores of value. It's one thing to have a mobile wallet or something like that, but what can you actually do with it in practical terms? So the more things that a person can do in a particular ecosystem or online, then the more useful then that a digital digital platform is. And she says that those are the types of things that would then help to push up financial inclusion on the continent, because it's about how useful something is as opposed to just, signing up and making sure that you're counting those particular numbers. Also interesting, one of the things that we spent a long time talking about is CIOs in South Africa, chief information officers versus chief technology officers versus chief technology and information officers versus chief information and security officers, all of these different acronyms, and how Mukuru is thinking about that particular role. They've decided on a CIO, and then they have functionality underneath that, and Sandy giving some insight into the role that women are playing in that particular space in her department across the industry, and how the pipeline is currently being fed versus how they would want the pipeline to be fed, and make sure that you have good skills, both on the what people consider to be the business analysis side of the type of vocation, versus the engineers and developers on the other side. And she actually says that their mission is to balance out, so that we don't continue to see the skew that we are seeing right now. So that's been it. It has been a really good conversation. We were chatting to Sandy Reader. She is the Chief Information Officer at Mukuru. Sandy, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much, Badil.
And that's been it for this edition of the Business Day Spotlight. Remember that you can find our latest podcasts on Business Live. That's under the podcast Business Day Spotlight tab on Twitter with hashtag BD Spotlight. And remember that you can review and subscribe for free on iono.fm, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, or wherever you choose to get your pods casted. I've been Mudiwa Gavaza of the Business Day and Financial Mail. And this has been another edition of the Business Day Spotlight, which is a multimedia live production. So from myself and the rest of the team, it is a good evening, good afternoon, and good morning.